Music, session number 28624, reel 13.
Every battalion was really required to have such people. Forward air controllers, officers in the front line, platoon commander is an obvious good choice, who has the capability and the training to direct supporting aircraft, the RAF fighter aircraft, onto targets you've identified. I did this course in 62 sometime in Cyprus, and a very good concentrated course. You live with the RAF, you fly with them, you go up, you see what it's like to sort of look for targets and attack targets at the speed at which they do. So you become aware of how little time you have to give them precise details. I mean, they're flying at such a rate that you can't ramble on talking about a target, because they're going to be on it in seconds, and they need very clear, precise, quick directions. And it's only by doing these courses, of course, that you can learn these things. And so back in Kenya, you know, on that particular maneuver, or if it was a maneuver, I mean, I had training sessions with them anyway. The RAF were based down at, had a big squadron down at Nairobi, and of course they need to practice too, and they need people who know how to direct them to practice with. So I had practice sessions out in the bush, out in Kenya, and also did it on the maneuver. So that's what that photo was about.
And when you did practice it, obviously there was RAF personnel there. But would there have been any more, like, Gordon Highlanders working alongside you, you know, giving orders?
Not at all. I was, I mean, the only people on the in the skies would be the RAF aircraft and pilots. And they might come out one at a time, or they might come in pairs. And the only people on the ground would be myself with a Land Rover and the driver. And but the driver would not be taking part in it. I would be directing it. He might be helping me make sure that the wireless was in good order, and he'd be qualified to do that, and the aerial was in place, and so on. So it was just the two of us on the ground and either one or two pilots above us.
And did you find it difficult, because you must have had good navigational skills, did you?
Yeah, you find, yes, I mean, you know, you to start with, I think you find it awkward. But once you get used to it, and it's like everything else, with practice you get much better at it, much quicker. And I found throughout the rest of my service, you know, when I was doing it a lot, you know, I was quite good at it. But if you have a long period, as we did, I mean, for example, in Borneo, I mean, for a year you never did it at all. And in Redford Barracks didn't do it at all. So you then go out to Germany and you're required to do it, and you are rusty again. But and what's good about being in practice is that you're in practice with the same pilots too, because you're talking to them the whole time. You get to know them. You go down to their mess and get to meet the people and know them, and you recognize their voice instantly, and they know you, and you work pretty well together, because you are a team.
And do you remember the type of aircraft you used at that time?
Yeah, they were, at that time they were Hunter T-7s, I think, Hunter fighter aircraft, and they were, yeah, just the plane of the day. They'd be very old now, and certainly you never see one now, but they were great aircraft.
And was that a jet, like we were?
Yeah, absolutely, yes, a jet.
Okay.
Yeah. And they would travel at about 500 knots an hour. They were moving very quickly, so you had to think quickly.
Mm-hmm. And how did you feel being an officer with the Gordon Highlanders, you know, suddenly up in one of these planes which is going very fast?
Well, you know, it was just a tremendous thrill to fly with them, because they were two seats, and it was amazing to watch what these young guys did and could do and did so well. I mean, developed a huge admiration for them, because as an infantry officer not used to it, you would suddenly find that you were just going straight up to the sun and then turning around, rolling over, then diving down, swooping on something, just not like any other flying you've ever done before. And of course the gravity pressure, the G pressure, and you wear a special belt for that to try and keep you conscious. I mean, as a new boy, you find that you're seeing red the whole time, literally red, because the blood pressure. And these fellows all suffered like that too to start with, but somehow they get used to it, and they can cope with it. But you're just sitting there at certain times, not on the level or a gentle climb or drop, but when they really apply the pressure, you're not seeing clearly. It is amazing. Just filled with admiration for them.
And did you have any after effects from that? You know, did you feel a sore head or anything after?
Well, it was remarkable, because they used to play this trick with everyone on their first time out, as you were coming in to land. And they're always practicing, those fellows. They then pull down a sort of blind over their screen so that they're landing as though in the dark. They're always training. And when you're coming to land, and you're quite relieved after about 40 minutes of this, the pilot will tell you what a terrific camp you've been, because, my goodness, you're the best infantryman I've ever been beside. He said, "How do you feel? Feeling sick?" I said, "No, I'm not. I'm really pretty well okay, thanks. Bit wobbly up there, but you've been terrific." And then when you land in the taxi off to wherever they're going to park the aircraft, you can see out of the window a number of their mates, the other pilots, standing by watching and waiting. And what you don't know is that they are having bets on it, because they are counting the paces as you get down out of the cockpit and start walking towards them. They are counting your paces, because they know that within, it's always 5 or 6 or 7 or certainly inside 10 paces, you're going to be violently sick. And they're all taking bets to see how many paces you manage. And there you were, you've just been telling someone you're feeling terrific. And it's funny, it's up there you don't feel sick. It's when you come back onto terra firma and are walking normally, but you're not really normal anymore, because you've been thrown around so much that you suddenly realize that you're not a great pilot yet, anyway. And they were all like that too. I mean, when they started off, they said they were all violently sick every time they came out, but then as time goes on, they just get used to it and they're not anymore.
And so did you often go up in the aircraft with them?
Yeah, a few times when we were out there. But only, these weren't joyrides. Their purpose was to part of your training, just to let you see how it's got to be done, and someone will be directing you and you're listening up there, and you realize then how you've got to do things. So there are only a few trips up. After that, you're firmly on the ground and practicing what you've been taught, and it's terrific how it can work. And the other great thing about these young pilots, the average age of 23, I think, in that squadron, 63 squadron, I think it was that when they had finished their sortie with you and they were signing off to go back to their base, they, rather than just say, "I'm off now," they used to say, "I'm leaving now." And their great trick was, when you were down with your Land Rover on the ground, your radio mast, which gave you the contact to them, ground to air, was 30 feet tall only, 10 yards. And every one of these fellows used to come down over you and touch your aerial with their wing. So they were under 30 feet, if you can imagine that, before they then just shot straight up into the sky again. Terrific guys.
And the first time that happened, were you quite frightened?
Not at all frightened. I was just fed up because no matter, you lie on all your maps and papers and everything, you lie on the ground just to keep everything intact. And even then, the roar of the plane and the section above whips your papers away, and you spend the next 20 minutes sort of recovering them. But they were terrific friends. Those are the very same people who, during the Kuwait crisis, if you remember when they were on bombing missions, used to fly on rolling dunes at night, you know, at heights of 50 feet, you know, to keep well below the radar and so on. And you can see how they were able to do it. They're just terrific pilots.
I'd wondered if, whilst you were in the aircraft, if you had actually to try and look at the maps. You know, I wondered if that had happened.
Yes, I mean, you do. I mean, they have their maps sort of strapped to their knee, and whether I strapped mine to my knee or not, or just held it. Yes, oh, indeed, you were following precisely the instructions that he was receiving, and just watching how he did it, and you know, that's how you learn.
Okay, and while you were in Kenya as well, I believe that you were involved in the organisation of an event at Flagship House.
Oh yes, I was yes, very lucky. Before I left Kenya, which was at the end of November or beginning of December in 63, we had been, the battalion had been asked to provide a guard of honour for General Goodwin, Dick Goodwin, who was the commander of East African Land Forces, and he lived at Flagstaff House, 4 or 5 miles outside Nairobi. And I was asked to, or ordered to, produce that guard, which is a 24-hour guard in the guard room at the gate of his house. And you have just organise the 8-hour shift. Also have a bugler and piper under command, because they sounded reveille and last post. And that was a very happy time. We had we were quartered in Nairobi itself, in the garrison barracks, and would drive out every morning. I would post the guard, and then I'd visit them during the day and certainly in the evening. And one of the most amazing things during the drive out each day for those few short miles was that we would come to a point that we were driving out about 5:30 in the morning to mount the guard at 6. There was a point where you could look in one direction and see Mount Kenya, the second highest mountain in Africa, and in the other direction you could look out to towards Tanganyika, as it was in those days, and you could see Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain. And both of them, because the sun had got going, there was no cloud there, because the cloud gathered immediately the sun appeared, and both pinnacles would be hidden for the rest of the day. But just at that particular time, you could see the tops of both of them. It was an awe-inspiring view. I remember that very clearly. But that was a very happy week. It was nice to be down in Nairobi, of course, and the jocks all enjoyed it too, because they had time off as well.
And was there any threat, or was it more ceremonial?
No, purely ceremonial.
And whilst you were in guard, were you in your best uniform, or like just like your normal?
Yeah, number one dress ceremonial, yeah, which were not the green doublets out of Kenya. They were white, because they were made of a cooler cotton linen, whatever it was. But number one dress, the smartest we've got.
And did you enjoy your time in Nairobi as well?
Oh yes, loved it. Yeah, you know, we, despite the fact that we were there for quite a long time in Kenya, our visits to Nairobi were very limited because we were training hard, and Nairobi was about 75 miles from Gilgal, so it wasn't something you could do in an evening or whatever. We had the occasional weekends there, but they were an occasional set over a week in the big city, and it was great fun.
And did you get any time off within that week?
Yes. Now, I had plenty, because once the guard was posted, and then there's a corporal of the guard, and we had a sergeant. Sergeant Will was with me there. There were and sufficient jocks to make sure that everyone got plenty of time off. It was a very nice thing to be given, this guard, and everyone recognized that. It was a gift, really. So whilst you were on duty and smartly dressed and so on, you were off. But when you came off, you just immediately cleaned your kit so that it was ready for the next time, and then you had a number of hours off. And of course, everyone had time to relax and swim or do whatever.
And was there any cocktail parties or anything associated with the guard?
I have to say, I was invited. The general was very kind to me, and I had dinner there, certainly, and certainly had two cocktail parties, I think. So I was very well looked after.
And were they grand affairs?
Oh, yes, they were. He very nice chap, General Goodwin, and very senior, high-ranking members of the forces there, but also the embassy people were always on his list because they would be inviting him too, of course. And just a general mix, but quite grand.
Okay. And had this week's guard that you were doing, had it taken a lot of training and preparation before you went there?
No, not huge amount. The drill aspect was typical of mounting guard, as we did every day, every night in barracks in Gilgal. A little more ceremonial to it, but almost an identicopy of that. So, we were all being drilled to do that, that just took 2 or 3 days.
Okay. And you mentioned the garrison as well. Can you give us a description of the garrison?
Well, the garrison barracks would be where, and there are a number of minor units, in and around Nairobi at that time. Second Scots Guards were there, but they were there as a battalion, so they're in their own barracks. The Staffordshire Regiment was there, but they're in their own barracks. Then you have the command headquarters, who also have their own barracks, but then you have a lot of minor units or people visiting who don't have their own barracks because they couldn't fill it. So they all go into what's called the garrison barracks, which is just a lot of minor units, very small detachments, intelligence detachment or something like that. People who work in sixes and eights or perhaps even bigger than that, but that is, and there's always spare accommodation there. So someone like the guard, had the Scots Guards been providing the guard, they would have just worked straight from their barracks to Flagstaff House and back all the time. We couldn't do that because we were 75 miles away, so we go into the garrison barracks and work from there.
And was it an old building?
Oh, I think it must have been, yes. Hard to remember now, but nothing to write home about.
Do you think that it had been the British who had built it, or do you?
I suspect, yes. During it would have been a wartime camp, I suspect. Yeah.
Okay. And at the end of the week, was there a special parade or anything?
No, we were just relieved, and I can't remember who relieved us. I think we relieved the Staffordshire Regiment. But no, one day it's a very brief ceremony, you hand over guard to the new guard, and that's all it is. And you march off into your truck, and then back to Gilgal when your week's over.
And were you quite pleased with how things had went at the end of the week?
Yes, oh yes, oh very. Yeah, a very good guard, and got the battalion received a nice note from the general saying that we'd acquitted ourselves well.
Okay. And you mentioned as well that this was just before you left in November 1963.
Yes, that's right. I'm sure it was November, and within 3 or 4 weeks, I think I was on my way home. And because I was already aware, I mean, I'd had a posting order, I was going to be posted away from the battalion to the Highland Brigade training depot to become a training officer there.
And had you requested that you wanted to be a training officer?
No, not at all. No, not something one would be encouraged to do anyway. In those early days of your career, you just do what you're told. And anyway, you know, I was more than happy to stay with battalion. But a training subaltern was needed at the depot, Gordon Ander one, and I was the one. So off I went.
And was there anyone else went with you, or were you the only one leaving early?
Yes, I mean, there would be postings taking place frequently. I mean, you know, officers in senior ranks would be sent off to do various jobs, staff jobs or training jobs or looking after the TA or lots of jobs. So there were postings taking place on a regular basis. But now I went off from my own. I was the going to the depot. There was another Gordon Hander at the depot, training officer, Nigel Oxley. So that made two of us there, but I went on my own.
Okay. And how did you manage to get back? Did they fly you back? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I flew out on the plane that flew the new commanding officer, the new Gordon Hander commanding officer, Colonel Bobby Smith. Arrived on the plane that then turned around and I went back on. He was relieving Colonel Charles Napier of command. But yes, you just, they, I think Monarch Airlines were the forces charter. In those days, you know, not much troop movement took place in military aircraft. I mean, they did on an operation, as I've described already, as we flew out to Swaziland or something. But just straightforward troop movements back to the UK or out to Kenya or whatever were done by the a charter airline that would tender. They all tendered every 3 years or whatever it was, and I think it was Monarch at the time who were the charter, forces charter, and I got on one of their aircraft, and with a lot of other service personnel, people perhaps going on leave or being posted, whatever. But it was a military passenger list that got into the civil charter.
And were you allowed to wear your uniform when you were going back? Or?
No. We never travelled in uniform. We always travelled in civvies, and that was just the way it was. There's no requirement to be in uniform. And you know, your passport in those days just said government official as occupation. It didn't say army or anything like that. So you just looked like a government official.
And what happened with the uniform and that you'd had out there? Because would it have been more lightweight than what you would have been going to use in November in Scotland?
Yes, I mean, a lot of the kids, indeed, mm-hmm. But you still had all your uniform with you. So, I mean, I had whatever I needed at Fort George was with me in Kenya. And whatever I had in Kenya came back with me to Fort George, and it would just sit in a wardrobe somewhere for the duration until it was needed again. But you had all your kit with you all the time.
Okay, so even your lightweight things you still kept with you?
Yeah, they all came back.
And you mentioned leave as well. I'd heard someone saying that whilst you were on overseas postings, you maybe got like leave before you went and then when you came back. Was that the case with yourself? Or?
Yes, that's invariably what happened. And of course, you know, if you were away for a long time, you had a leave entitlement, which you didn't always get, depending on what you were doing. But certainly it was typical of a battalion prior to move, goes on leave for whatever the CO thinks is a suitable period, 7 days, 10 days, 14. And then on return, it's usual to come back in sufficient time to allow you the same length of another holiday before taking over the duties in your new area of work.
Okay, so whilst you were in Kenya, did you get any leave?
I certainly did. I can remember two leaves, and I think that's probably what I got, all I got, but that was all right. And I went on holiday with a friend, Robin Forkus, who was in the town. We went to Tanganyika and Dar es Salaam, and we drove down to Dar es Salaam and then across to Zanzibar, where we'd had such a happy time together. And then another holiday I took in Uganda, in Tebe, Lake Victoria, in Tebe, Kampala, and up, not to the source of the Nile, but up to the Blue and White Nile, which are famous for the crocodile and hippo. I mean, terrific game up there, and I saw huge amounts. And just terrific holidays. So those were the two leaves, and I think that's what I got.
And was it safe enough, you know, for a white person to be driving about in Africa at that point?
Oh, yeah. Well, we certainly thought it was, and I think it was, yeah. I think if there was a safety element, it wasn't the Africans. I think it was the wildlife. You know, because they were plentiful and big beasts. I do remember being in a lodge on that leave I had in Uganda, where a buffalo had come wandered in between me and my little lodge. There would be a central hall, which was the sort of public areas, the dining room, the lounge, and the kitchens and so on, and then you would go off to a little chalet. It was too grand a term, but you know, your bedroom would be sort of thatch and wood, and they were dotted around in the sort of camp area, and until that buffalo moved, you would have to wait. And eventually he did move on, but you know, I suppose if he'd decided to spend the night there, you'd have gone without dinner. But so I think the safety bit was not a factor at all.
And had they warned you of things, you know, like this? I don't mean the army, but I mean the lodge keepers. Had they warned you that the buffalo were dangerous?
Well, no, I mean, they probably hadn't. You know, probably a sleepy lot. But we'd been in Kenya long enough to know about the wildlife, and we used to sleep rough an awful lot of the time, and we were well aware of it. Yeah.
And places like that sound quite expensive. Do you remember how, you know, with being on an officer's wage, how it felt at the time to you? Was it expensive or was it quite reasonable?
No, they were expensive, but you know, we. This has sounded very grand, this particular lodge, but a lot of the time we would sleep in the car, or we would sleep outside the car. On our trip to, I forget how long it was, but probably about 10 days to Tanganyika and Zanzibar and back, but we